I'm back from the wilderness.
Where did you go? I saw some pictures between you and your wife. You were posting pictures, and I couldn't figure out where you guys went, which is probably a good thing.
Yeah, our sole goal was to be unfindable by Joe Buehling and
Awesome.
friends.
Well, you did good.
No, we went to Minocqua, Wisconsin. So I'm not sure if you've heard of Minocqua. It's a little island town in northern Wisconsin, which is it's a little touristy town, but it's a cool little place, and it's really nice in the summer. So my parents rented a place on the lake, and we went up there for the week. And I would go into town in the morning to work a little bit on some agent efficiency stuff at a coffee shop. But other than that, did not have cell signal, did not have Wi-Fi, so was able to disconnect and get actually a lot of reading done. I read 2.5 books while we were up
Whoa,
there.
nice. So what were the books?
Well, I finished the one we're going to talk about today,
Okay.
Powerful Engagement by Jim Lear and Tony Schwartz. Also read Born for This by Chris Guillebeau. I think that's how you say his name.
Gillibo?
And then I,
Is that what you're trying to say?
yes,
Okay.
yes. I threw an extra R in there, I guess.
Guirabo. Okay. Got it.
And then I started the, I think it's The Blessed Life by Robert Morris.
Okay. Nice. Wow. So a reading vacation.
Yeah. Turns out when you don't have any internet connection and you can't check any social media accounts and no one can get a hold of you to interrupt you, you can get a lot of reading done.
Oh, I bet. I bet. So here's I'm going to go through this follow-up piece because there's one of these questions I really want to know. So we were talking last time about how, so last time it was deep work. And we were talking about scheduling your day. I want to know, Mike, how did the digital calendar thing work out? Did you do it? Did it work?
I did. Obviously, last week I was gone, so I didn't really have much use for it last week.
True.
But I did do it this week, and I like it so far. It doesn't really provide very rigid constraints like I think most people think of digital calendars. I don't have alarms turned on at all, so it's not telling me, in 5 minutes you have to be here working on this. But I do find it helpful to the night before create all of those blocks on my calendar and plan out how I'm gonna go about my day. And I've found that by sticking to hour-long blocks at least, so really I try to keep the breaks on the hour. Sometimes I'll have to compromise that and do them at 30-minute intervals, but I don't stack like a bunch of 30-minute time blocks together. I try to keep like big chunks on my calendar that I'll set aside time to work on something. I'll work on it knowing that I have the time and space to work on it. And a lot of times I'll get done a little bit early. And that gives me a little bit of a chance to relax and do something else or start on the next task, whatever I want to do. But it provides more framework and direction, I think, for my day. And I think it's helping me get more done just by making me think through this stuff the day. Really the night before. That's the key in my opinion.
So, whenever you, I'm still trying to get my head around how you can do this because it doesn't work for me. I really want this to work for me. How do you have your calendar open all day? Like whenever you're going through your regular day, do you keep a digital calendar like up on your Mac the whole time? Is that what you're doing?
Well, I do have Fantastical in my menu bar.
Okay.
But I don't really work off of that. Like, I'm not constantly checking that. By looking at it the night before and filling out the big blocks of time, I know pretty much what my day is going to look like without having to consult the calendar. But one thing I've done is on my iOS devices, so my phone in particular, I've hidden every other calendar except the one that I created for this, which I've called a Canvas calendar.
Okay.
And so when I do check my phone, that is the only thing that I see. And then I also use that Canvas calendar whenever people want to schedule additional, they want to meet for coffee or they want to re record a podcast, whatever. Like that's the calendar that I'm basing my availability off of.
Okay, so that makes sense. But I'm really jealous, Mike. I want the digital thing to work, but it doesn't. Because I still have to do mine on paper. I've just got a notebook that I have to write it all down in. And I do mine, I think I'm like you. I do mine the night before. And then whenever I get up in the morning, I'm looking at it while I'm grabbing breakfast for the first time in the morning. So anyway, that's it's something I'm very jealous of. So I'm glad it's working for you.
Okay, so I have to ask. You said breakfast for the first time. How many breakfasts do you eat?
Depending on the day, it's typically...
Are you a hobbit? Do you eat 11sies?
Yeah. So I eat first... I get up at 5 in the morning. Though lately I've been getting up at 4. I'm not sure if that's such a smart idea. Especially after this book. I'm going to get ridiculed for that one. But I've been getting up at 4 because I've been working on that OmniFocus course. And I really want it done. So I've been getting up an hour early to do that. Anyway, whenever I get up, whether it's 4 or 5, one of those two, I go downstairs and I grab breakfast then, which is usually 2 eggs and a banana. I'm creature habit. I eat the exact same thing every single morning. And then I go to work until roughly 8 o'clock when the girls start to get up for the day. And once they're up for the day, I go up and grab breakfast with them again. And then I go back to work somewhere around 9. And then somewhere mid-morning, well, at that point, late morning, I get hungry and I go upstairs and I grab something. And it's usually around 11. So maybe... I might be a hobbit, yes, supposedly.
You have hobbit tendencies.
Yes, I would say I have hobbit tendencies, of course. And it's interesting, and we'll get into this a little later, but the whole... Because I've kind of set up my day like that, not intentionally. It's just kind of morphed into that just because I know... I've just been paying attention to when I get tired and when I feel like I can't keep going anymore. And once I've gotten to a point where I know I just can't go anymore, I take a break in some form or another. And it just kind of happens to put me in these oscillations of go work your tail off, take a break, go work your tail off, go take a break. Like I just kind of go through that cycle throughout my day, which is just because I get tired and I'm lazy, Mike.
I think it actually is, you've been implementing this managing your energy stuff that Jim Lear and Tony Schwartz have been talking about without even realizing it.
That's a nice segue there. Well done.
Yeah, before we actually jump into the book, though, you want to talk about your follow-up stuff?
Oh, right, yeah.
The discussion site over the social media and then also the email update?
Yeah, so let me go with the discussion site first. So I created a new category on that thing for links because that was the one thing I was missing with that whole forum is a way to share links that I think are interesting. And that's been going pretty well. There's a couple people that have been responding to that, which is about identical to what I saw on Twitter anyway. So it's not really any different, even though there's fewer people following me there. So yes, so I've been focusing on the discussion site more than Twitter, and that's gone I think really well. It hasn't really changed anything, which is probably saying something since it takes much less time to do my activities on the discussion site than it does on Twitter. So there's probably something to be said of that. The other one was email. And I think I mentioned that I changed my contact form or put in a contact form and did some things there. Mike, my email went from about 300 in a day down to about 40.
Nice.
I can handle 40. I can do 40 quick. Yeah, because I was used to 300, so doing 40, holy cow, that's simple.
That's significant progress.
Yeah, no kidding. And oddly enough, because I don't know if it's because of or as a result of, but I've had a lot more leads on building websites lately, and they've been coming via phone calls instead of emails. I don't know if that's good or bad, but I've had more business pickup at the same time. Feels like it's related in some form, but I'm not real sure. It's interesting, at least. So, long story short, email. I think I'm in a really good place now.
Cool.
I think. I'm going to say, I think. Okay, so we keep alluding to it. What book did we go through? The Power of Full Engagement. And why did you pick this, Mike?
I honestly just picked it because it's been one of those books that I think everybody except me in the productivity space has read over the course of the last several years, and I was kind of ashamed of it, so I'm like, hey, let's read it for Bookworm.
Well, as a good example of that, up until probably about 3 months before we started this podcast, I really didn't read much at all, if ever, as far as books go. So even in my limited state and not ever really reading books, this was still a book that I read. So you're finally caught up, Mike.
Thanks.
Not to rub salt in your wounds there, but
yeah.
So he starts off, well, I suppose I shouldn't say he, they. I wish they would spell out who did most of the writing and who was writing each individual piece. That's the thing I always struggle with whenever they're co-authored, is who wrote what part. I always want to know, because I want to know who to blame for certain quotes.
True. Yeah, sometimes you got one guy's name that's bigger on the front, but there's no visual cues on
right.
this one.
This one has nothing. But I love that they start the whole book off, and the premise of the book is that managing energy, what's the byline? Managing energy, not time, is the key to high performance and personal renewal. And I think there's some value in that, and we'll get into a lot of this, I'm sure. But to make his point, make their point, man, I'm going to do that this whole episode. I know I am, Mike. To make their point, they tell the story of Roger B., and they have a ton of stories through this whole book, which is awesome because it really helps cement and help you to understand the concepts that they're getting at. But he tells a story about this guy by the name of Roger B. and how he feels overworked, he's tired, stressed, has no time for family, just overall miserable guy. And I know, because this is a reread for me, as I was talking about earlier, but the first time and this time both, whenever I go through that story, it does two things. One, it makes me really excited to read the rest of the book. And two, it reminds me an awful lot of my corporate days, Mike. It just sounds an awful lot like, not necessarily me and what I was doing and how I was living, but a lot of the executives that I worked under and for. Yeah, it definitely reminded me of a lot of their lifestyles, just in general. So it kind of hit home for me.
Yeah, the story of Roger B. is they started off and they say, we're going to tell you a story about this guy and we're going to tell you about all the improvements that he made at the end. And if that was the only story that they used, that I think, at least for me, may have been a little bit more effective. But they used so many stories throughout this book that it was kind of like, oh boy, here's another one. I lost count. There's got to be at least like 30 different stories. I mean, it makes sense. Another one of Jim Lear's books is The Power of Story. So,
well, yeah, that makes sense. Because there's what, 11? There's 11 chapters. The last one's all about Roger, though. So probably 10 chapters. I know they go through at least somewhere between three to five stories per chapter. So it might be over 30.
Yeah, that part got a little bit repetitive for me personally. I know some people really connect with those stories, and I did for a couple of them, but towards the end I was like, okay, yeah, I get it, you're telling me another story. And a lot of them even sound, I'm sure they're real because they've done the research behind this, and they've got the corporate training university or whatever they call it, you know, where people actually go through this program, but they almost sound like they're made up, don't they?
Oh, yeah, because they're using a first name, and then they always use a letter for the last name. Yep. I don't know if it's the real name and they just didn't give you the last, but, you know, I've got George D., and I've got Roger B., and I've got, I mean, I just found those just from flipping it open. That tells you how many stories are in this thing. Peter D. I mean, they just have tons of these, and they're kind of generic names and then a single letter. So there's times I'm like, okay, is this the same person? Is this a different one? Are you going back to an old one? I'm with you. It just seemed like there was a ton of stories and they were easy to get confused. And honestly, a lot of the principles between the stories were fairly similar. It was pretty easy to get lost in them.
It's like you read one at the beginning of a chapter and then they talk about the principle that relates to that person. And they tell another story and then they continue on telling the principle and then they tell another story. And at that point, you're just like, okay, I get it.
Are we done?
A lot
yet?
Of examples of how this works. But I mean, yeah, it's not necessarily bad. It just got a little bit repetitive for me. But all of the stories that they tell, they kind of illustrate the four basic principles that they they cover in here. And mm-hmm. Roger B is probably the most, it's the one they go deepest in. They tell his story. They use more pages, I guess, devoted to Roger
right,
B.
Right.
But really, even like the way that they tell the stories, it doesn't even seem like it's really deeper. Like the way that they bring more details to it, it's, I don't know. At least when I read that story, it didn't really seem like they were fleshing out this character where I felt like I knew him more. It was just more like, oh, now he's doing this sort of a thing. So I think it could have been a lot more powerful if we were able to like really dissect the life of Roger B and not just here's exactly what happened to him and he went from point A to point B and now his life is a whole lot better. But anyways, the four principles that they really hit home through all of these stories and specifically the life of Roger B are that, I'll just go through these real quickly because I wrote them down.
Yep.
Full engagement requires drawing on four separate but related sources of energy. I thought this was a really cool point. Physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual. And we can come back to that in a little bit, but the spiritual one in particular, like that really hit home with me and it was kind of like an aha moment, like, hey, that makes sense. Number two was because energy capacity diminishes both with overuse and underuse, we have to balance our energy expenditure with intermittent energy renewal. So you can't just keep going, you have to recharge. Number three, to build capacity, we have to push beyond our normal limits, training in the same systematic way that elite athletes do, which is kind of along the lines of deep work, where we talked about how this is a skill that you can develop and it gets easier to click in and do deep work and establish flow and all that. And then the fourth one, the positive energy rituals, highly specific routines for managing energy are the key to full engagement and sustained high performance. I thought that one in particular was really cool. And I like that that's the emphasis at the end of the book. I mean, kind of jumping all around here, but we already mentioned Roger B at the beginning. At the end, they kind of talk about what Roger B was doing to establish these rituals. And I think that's a really important key where if you just read the book, you can miss that one if you're not careful. But because I guess my perspective and working with Asian Deficiency, where we've got a product based on rituals, like I understand the science behind this. I understand why those are so important, how those are really your body's efficiency mechanism. Like if you really want energy management to stick, you can't skip that last part. And there, I think, could be a tendency to look at this and say, oh yeah, I get the first three principles. I understand the areas. I understand that it diminishes. I understand I need to increase my capacity. And then if all you did was try to formulate a plan from there, you're going to make it a lot harder than if you actually applied the fourth principle, which is the positive energy rituals.
I think there's, because you go through these, and now that you've said those principles out loud, I'm reflecting on those as compared to the four levels that he called out. Did we mention those? Did you just mention those? I'm losing my mind here, Mike.
Yeah, the first principle, I don't know that they were, I don't know if I qualified them as levels, but there were four different areas, the physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, and I know why I know why I think of it as levels, Mike. It's honest. Well, it's Asian Efficiency. They have a they have an article. I'm gonna hunt this down for the show notes. They have an article about this book somewhere. I know you didn't write it, and they have a pyramid. There's a picture of a pyramid in there, and they spell out the, because I know physical's on the bottom, physical, emotional, mental, and then spiritual. So they build on top of each other in the pyramid on Asian Efficiency. I don't think I saw that in this book at all, but I remember seeing it on, so I think Tan is the one that put that together. And ultimately what that was showing me is you got to get your physical side figured out first. Then you can get the emotional side figured out. Then you can go to mental and then spiritual. You kind of build from the bottom up. I know we talk about this a little bit with GTD, where in theory you should start at your life mission and your life goals. And these guys are kind of saying the same thing with the spiritual side. If you got to figure out what your core values are, you need to figure out what your weaknesses are, what's your mission, what are you shooting for, and then you use that to craft these rituals and the goals that you're shooting for and your positive energy habits. And I think there's a lot of value in that, but I also think there's a little bit of a danger in going all high and mighty, if you will, of how what am I supposed to be doing? What's the best case scenario? How do I do all of this? And getting to a point where you're just focused too high level and not so much in the day-to-day. How do I actually get the energy to keep going in the afternoon? A lot of people struggle with like trying to keep moving right after lunch. There's kind of that lull period that we all deal with. I think the Spaniards have that figured out with the siesta. Come on, bring it back. I think there's a lot of that has some traditional and historical value, but we don't see that in today's world. And I think these guys would say that there's a lot of value in maintaining that even as a culture, but we really don't do that anymore. If you worked corporate and you went over and you took a nap in the early afternoon, they'd make fun of you. You might lose your job. Like, there's just a lot of negatives that can come with that.
True. They did share in there that Winston Churchill was a napper, though. So if you shared that,
right,
maybe that would help your case.
wasn't Teddy Roosevelt a napper too? Is he the? There was some other president that was, not other president, but a president, I remember, that was doing that. Because Churchill wasn't a president. yeah, gotta get your facts.
Yeah, right. I don't remember who it was, but there's a lot of really successful people who actually do take naps in the middle of the day. Going back to your point, though, about the different levels, they didn't explicitly have that diagram, but I have seen those diagrams. And I shouldn't say they didn't explicitly have it because I just don't remember seeing it. I did write down, though, a quote which they said, the quantity of energy that we have to spend at any given moment is a reflection of our physical energy. Our motivation to spend what we have is largely a spiritual issue. So the spiritual level of energy really is all about finding your why, and that kind of drives everything else. So I think you could articulate that or frame that as different levels, and that's going to be, you know, that if you headed a pyramid and that's at the top, really, or what you're saying is that if you're working down, you know, that's going to really permeate through all the different levels below it until what you actually do on the surface, your day to day, you know, your work, your tasks that you do, how you manage your time, that is going to be, that's going to originate, that motion is going to originate from the spiritual level.
Okay, so I found it. If you have your book in front of you, page 201, it's in the resources section, number 24. I'm going to get specific here. number 24 on page 201, there's that pyramid. And it's exactly what I was thinking of. So physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual from the bottom up. And then next to it, they have an arrow pointing down. And in the arrow, it says change, which I think is what you're saying is if you want to really make change to what you do to stay fit. If you're going to start going to the gym and you're going to start running or lifting weights or whatever it is you decide to do, if you're going to make that decision and do it, you have to have some core value that you connect with on an internal deep level that's not some external factor. Like, you're not trying to look good for your wife. You're not, like, that doesn't always work. It can temporarily, but it doesn't work long term. But if you have something internal, a value that you hold that can drive that change, that's where those rituals come from. Is that what you're getting at?
Yep, exactly. Although I don't necessarily think it just applies to change. I think it really applies to any sort of action that you take in your life, with the exception of the rituals. Obviously, like I said, that's your body's efficiency mechanism. So it's easy to just, once you've creased that into your psyche, that is just something that you do, it becomes a lot easier. You don't have to reference that why all the time. But if you're in the middle of doing hard work, if you're doing deep work, that why is really important, because if you don't keep going back to the drawing board, if you don't keep consulting your goals or your vision, if you don't write it down in a place where you can actually see it, then it's easy to lose momentum and then just give up. I mean, you see that every January when people are like, I'm going to join the gym, I'm going to get in shape. And then by January 31st, 9/10 of them are gone.
Yeah.
You know, it's because they don't have, like you said, strong enough why.
though sometimes you can take advantage of that because I know I think it was 3 years ago. 3 years ago, I was looking to get into cycling. So I have a road bike and I go cycling occasionally whenever the girls, I've got a little trailer that I can pull behind the bike. So I'll take the road bike out and go for a spin occasionally. And I've been looking to do a lot more of that. So I have been grabbing my bike and doing that a little bit more lately. And I told my wife, it's like, okay, I'd like to upgrade my bike and get something a little nicer, but I'm just not ready to do it this summer. I might do something over the winter. And just in the midst of that conversation, it struck me as like, oh, right, the best time to buy bikes, because I have a friend who likes to buy these types of, like, these higher-end road bikes. He likes to buy them, fix them up, and then resell them. And he has found that the best time to buy them is about the first week of February, because people buy them around New Year's, and then they realize that they're not going to stick with it, so they go to sell them somewhere in February. So, okay, you can take advantage of that, too.
Let's talk about the energy quadrant, because that was one of the things that I really liked about this.
Okay.
This made so much sense to me, and it was kind of illuminating, I guess, to see how I would typically naturally manage my energy according to this quadrant. So the quadrant is really two axes, X and Y, and with a center point, and then you've got the, you know, upper left, upper right, lower left, lower right. And so if you were going on the Y axis, so the top would be high and the bottom would be low. And then on the right side, so right of the 0, 0 point would be positive and left of that would be negative. And what they said in here is that the key to full engagement is to manage the ebbs and flows of your energy between the high and the low instead of bouncing all over the place from positive to negative. I personally think that I tend to bounce back and forth between positive and negative, but still in the high part of this quadrant. And what they're suggesting, and this makes so much sense to me, is instead of going back and forth, in my case, on the x-axis, and maybe we can find an image here that we can put in the show notes so people can reference this.
Yep.
But instead of bouncing back and forth on the x-axis between the positive and negative, stay in the positive but bounce back and forth on the y-axis. So you've got those high intensity positive experiences, and then by being proactive and being intentional and choosing to come down off of that euphoric high and manage your energy in a way where you can be more relaxed, you can be more mellow, it's more peaceful or tranquil. You know, you're able to allow your body to recover and ramp up for that next period of high intensity, that you don't have to drift over into the negative.
I think this is what I was talking about at the beginning with kind of my daily routine and how I do things, because when I get up in the morning, I have kind of a relaxing, you know, get myself ready and go for the day, grab a shower, grab breakfast. And I don't rush through that. I just kind of take my time going through it. And then once I've done that, I go into my work mode. And after reading Deep Work, I've kind of just treated that as a deep work session. So I don't check email. I don't deal with anything up until second breakfast rolls around. But I go through one of those deep work sessions leading up to breakfast. And that's roughly 2 to 2.5 hours, kind of depending on the day and what time I get up in the morning. But once I've gotten through that and I go up for breakfast, it's always fun because I get to go see my girls. They're always excited in the morning. We run around the house. We have fun. Make breakfast. I mean, we've got an hour to do breakfast. It's probably longer than necessary, but we have fun while we're doing it. And then I can go back to work for a few hours, do another deep work session until lunch, take another 30 minutes to an hour for lunch, do the same thing. And you get this. I mean, it's a cycle throughout the day. And it's kind of the same process where you go through a really intense process of doing your work and spending a lot of energy. And then you go do something that's refreshing and fun and re-energizing. And then it gives you the boost to get back into it. And that's, I'm going to kind of summarize the whole book here. To me, whenever I finish this book, and again, this is the second time I'm through it. So for me, I've known about some of this oscillation process and this, you know, burn energy, build energy process for a while. And I can't say that I've been awesome at it. We talked about how we sometimes have these grandiose plans and these awesome action items that we're going to take, and they tend to fall off. Well, this is a prime example of that, because I came off of this book, I think it was a year and a half, 2 years ago when I read it, and I did the whole mission statement, did the values and weaknesses thing, and I have been reviewing those for a long time, but I haven't really seen them in the right light, I guess would be the way to say it, Mike, just because it's not something that I've actively tried to make decisions on and change rituals based on those. It's just been kind of a, well, here's what I value. That's interesting. I'll just kind of keep that in mind. And then that's where it dies. And I've never really done anything with it. But I just want to make that point that sometimes we put some of this stuff in place. It sounds awesome at the beginning, and then over time it kind of falls away. And then you do something, you read another book, and you reread the original book, and then it rekindles some of that energy and that motivation to get it up and running again. And this is a prime example of that for me, because this is a case where I feel that need to just be more intentional with that daily cycling that I have going on. So I've got that cycling ritual built in. I just need to make sure that I'm doing it intentionally. But that's, to me, the ultimate behind the whole of the book, is that you have to figure out where you value things, and then where your points of potential lack are, like where you're potentially weak, and then look for ways to either increase those or focus on your values. And whenever you go through the process of building in these daily rituals where you have these set periods of time and these set ways of doing things to calm yourself down, to make the transition from work to home, to get yourself fired up at work, you know, to do a lot of these things, you have to have these rituals to make those transitions. And I think if you just think of the whole book as understanding how things oscillate, take the oscillations and take advantage of building in energy building rituals to help you combat some of the areas that you tend to be lacking in, I think that sums up the mass of the book, because a lot of the stories they tell are based around those exact principles.
Yeah, I agree. The big thing that you don't get from the stories, though, and is the whole sprint and then recover idea that they talk about. They mention that life is not a marathon, it's a series of sprints. And going back to the energy quadrant, you know, understanding that I want to bounce back and forth between a high intensity and low intensity to stay in the positive. I think that mapping out my day using large blocks on my calendar, just the fact that I am putting those in place, actually helps me do that better. Because if I set aside 2 hours to work on this video for Asian efficiency and I get done in an hour and a half, then I have a half an hour to wind down, and I'll go do something for that half hour that is not high intensity. I'll go do a productive meditation like we talked about last time and take my dog for a walk or something. And those little pockets of time, when you actually set aside, I'm going to work on this for 2 hours, and the next thing that you're going to work on doesn't have to start for another 30 minutes. That's the natural inclination then. It's not, in the past, what I would have done is have my list of things which I need to do, and I would still not get everything done. But as soon as I got done with one thing, I would instantly maintain that high intensity and jump into the next thing. But just by framing it a little bit and not having specific times that I'm going to do this exact thing at this exact time, but just like the blocks of time, I'm finding that that is helping me manage my energy more effectively. And that's really the key. And that's what they say in the book anyways. And I'm beginning to see that in my own life, is that the real key to high performance is not how you manage your time, but it's really how you manage your energy. Because if you manage your energy well, then during those times when you are head down on a task, you're going to get it done quicker. You'll be more productive, you'll be more efficient, and then you'll have more time, more disposable time, I guess, if you want to use the idea of like disposable income, you know, not finances, but time on your calendar. You'll have more disposable time like that where you can then intentionally ramp down. And I think that is the biggest thing that I got out of this book, is recognizing that those ebbs and flows, those have to take place. It is impossible to just go, 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 go all day long, because you will wear out by the end of the day and you will not be as productive the next day. If you continually burn yourself out and you do not give yourself a chance to recover, you don't even realize it a lot of times. You think that you've got this, that we're superhuman and we're stronger than we think we are. But if you actually look at how effective you are, and a lot of times we just don't ever keep score, so we don't have the metrics in front of us. That's what putting stuff on the calendar has done for me, is I can say, well, this task usually takes me 2 hours to do. And then if I manage my energy well, it doesn't take me 2 hours to do it. It takes me an hour to do it. And then I look at that, I see a consistent pattern there, and I'm like, oh yeah, I guess I actually am way more efficient at this. I get a lot more good ideas a lot sooner. They're in quicker succession when I actually apply this stuff. So the calendar is the way that I'm keeping score, I guess, but that's really illuminated to me that, yeah, this is like next level productivity stuff. A lot of people will focus on the time management, and that's good. I mean, you do need to look at your tasks and what you say you're going to get done in the span of a day. All of that stuff does need to take place within the context of your calendar, what time you've got to work with. But if you can take that a step further and start managing your energy, then it just makes everything simpler. It's a cheat code. It's like the mushroom in Super Mario. You know, you're a productivity superhero now, which sounds a little bit extreme and grandiose, but I really do think, like, I've seen that just in this week, and I have every intention of continuing to manage my time this way. But yeah, it's been really cool.
I can tell you love this.
I do. While I didn't really care for the writing style, like the ideas that were in this book,
right,
I absolutely resonated with me.
Yeah. I know it's fun listening to you kind of go on a little rant, but it seems like whenever, and I'm prime example of this, I'd fall into this, it's me to a T. When I first got into the whole productivity space, I was working corporate. I mentioned that all the time. I had too much stuff trying to pull at my time. So I did the whole time management thing. How do I schedule my day? And then you get into something like this. How do you manage your energy, and how do you make sure that you're on point during that time? But the funny thing to me is that it's almost like a chicken and egg conversation, because you almost need the energy to make sure that you're planning your time the right way so that you can manage your energy, but you need to manage your time so that you can build the energy. Do you get it? Like, there's this little cycle that seems to be going on. It's easier, of course, to do your time management than it is the energy management, in my opinion. But I'm with you on, once you get this kind of time management thing figured out, and I think, honestly, Cal Newport last time hit this to a T of scheduling your time and how do you focus for a certain amount of time. He seems to nail that really well. And then this tells you, how do you build the energy so that you can endure that, so that it's not just going to kill you whenever you sit down to do 3 hours of deep work.
Exactly. And there's a quote in here that I absolutely loved. It said, "Without time for recovery, our lives become a blur of doing, unbalanced by much opportunity for being." I really think, especially for a knowledge worker, that is so important. And really, it doesn't apply just to knowledge workers. I think probably the people that they're targeting with, like, their corporate fitness or corporate training, university or whatever, they are going to be more like management level CEO type people that really understand these concepts. But I think that this is key, and this applies to just about anybody.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I know there's, and he even has some points in here that, because if you talk to the older crowd, I don't know how else to say it, but if you talk to folks who are starting to deal with, say, memory loss or physical fitness isn't there, they have to use a cane or a wheelchair at times, there's a lot of instances that, and he calls out a few of them, like, as we get older, just the muscles that it takes to take learning a language, for example. He mentioned that because of our society and the way that we tend to do things, we Google everything. We say, you know, we ask our devices to give us the answer to questions. Whenever you have that ability, you just don't have the need to work your memory muscles nearly as much and nearly as often. And I've been reading a bunch of articles, like scholarly articles, about how helping kids memorize, because we don't memorize in school really at all anymore. We're always trying to learn how to find the information instead of memorizing the information itself, such as like poems and such. But that there seems to be a lot of research going on right now about how having kids memorize things like poems or long blocks of text can actually help them be top of class and have better writing skills, better speaking skills. And it's purely based on the memorization versus, you know, doing actual training in those areas. And he calls this out a little bit in here too, of how if you were to work your memory muscles in that way, if you're constantly working on memory, then learning a language is not nearly as difficult as it is for most of us today, because we just don't memorize really ever right now. At least I don't. And that, because I've thought about, do I pick up another language at some point? I don't really want to do that because it's a pain in the rear and I don't have the time for it. Well, it's also partly that I don't have the memory skills right now to handle that, because I haven't been working that muscle. That's one of the premises here, is in order to build a muscle, in order to get better at one of these energy levels, you have to work it a certain amount and then let it recover. You don't want to overwork it, like you were saying earlier. You don't want to underwork it, but you need to work it so that it can grow and continue to build. Does that make any sense? I feel like I just went on a long goat trail.
No, it does make sense. And I think that it really comes back to establishing the why. And that's, you know, you said it's a chicken and egg situation. Like, you need to establish your why, to establish the need to manage your energy, to really take the time to figure out what your why is.
Right.
He has a quote. There's a quote in there. It says, clarifying purpose takes time, quiet, uninterrupted time, which is something that many of us feel we simply don't have. And it's true. Like, if you just look at your schedule right now, you might say, well, I don't have the physical time to sit down and think high level about my life. But if you don't do it, things won't get easier. So I don't know. There's going to be pain in the short term, but it really is important. Where is that other quote he says? Oh, the most compelling source of purpose is spiritual. The energy derived from connecting to deeply held values beyond self-interest. Purpose creates the destination. It drives full engagement by prompting our desire to invest focus energy in a particular activity or goal. We become fully engaged when we care deeply, when we feel what we are doing really matters. Purpose is what lights us up, floats our boats, feeds our souls. So you could say, I don't have the time to establish my purpose, but once you take the time to establish the purpose, everything else gets easier. If you establish a purpose for wanting to memorize something or learn a new language, that gets a whole lot easier. But a lot of people won't take the time to figure that out. And I think it really ties into what he calls a hero's journey. There's four parts to the hero's journey. He says the first part is the call to adventure. The second part is the supreme ordeal. Third part is the victory and the celebration. And the fourth part, you repeat it. But most people don't pursue that hero's path. He says, the simple, almost embarrassing reality is that we feel too busy to search for meaning. And I think that's really, really sad. It's the most important thing I think that we could do, is to establish that meaning.
Isn't that pathetic? I feel like, yeah, I'm not in, I feel like I hate my job. Well, have you ever figured out what you want to do? Well, no, I don't have time to figure out what I want to do because I'm too busy hating my current job.
Exactly.
What? It just doesn't make sense, because it's so simple. Like, it seems so simple. Like, just sit down and figure out what's your purpose in life. Like, what's your end mission in life? I just had a meeting with some guys about a month ago about this, of how do you come up with a mission statement for yourself. And ultimately, what we were getting at is you have to find the way that suits you, using the skills and talents that you have and have been given, and find a way to help other people using those skills. And if you can find a way to help other people do that, because if you can help other people, I mean, you talk to people who are in their 80s and 90s and you ask them, what's the meaning in life? They'll tell you there's a lot of meanings in life. And the ultimate that a lot of them ever mention is that they derive a lot of joy and pleasure out of helping the people around them. Like, that's, you know, giving to other people, whether it's time or money, doesn't matter, but giving to other people can bring you to that ultimate joy in life. And if you're finding ways to help others and you make that as part of your vision and your mission in life, I mean, you've got a pretty good goal to shoot for. But we don't take time to do this. I mean, we just don't. We don't stop long enough. We're too busy going to soccer practice to figure out what it is that we want to actually do with the skills we have.
Right. And he shares a quote in there by Arthur Ashe, who is a pretty famous tennis player. He said, "From what we get in life, we make a living. From what we give, we make a life." And I completely agree that giving and the focus on others is really, really important. It's one of the things that attracted me to Asian Efficiency in the first place, is their core values line up very much with my family's core values. The first one is glow green, become the best version of yourself that you can, so that number two, you can pull others up. It's all about helping people reach their full potential, not just you achieving a certain milestone or accumulating enough stuff. That's really, really important. And we've actually articulated our core values as a family. And I had a graphic designer friend, Jared Picker. I wish Jared had a Twitter handle so I could point people to him, because he's really talented. But if you have any design needs, he's the one who did the logo for Bookworm, by the way.
Okay. So, does he have a website?
He does not.
Does he know?
Talk to him about that.
Does he know what the internet is?
Yeah, he's a full-time graphic designer for a local company here, and he's pretty happy with his situation, but he does some stuff on the side, and he's really, really talented. But I'll give you a copy of this. You can put it in the show notes, but he designed the core values that we use for our family, and there are five of them. I just want to pull up the image here real quick so I don't mess them up. Yeah, that would be bad.
Yeah.
First one is love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And so that specifically, like, heart, soul, mind, and strength, everything that you have, which is why I wanted to pull this up before I just rattled these off. All right. Second one, give selflessly by finding the need and meeting it. I mean, that really is what you're talking about, but that's really important to us. And then the rest of them, just so people have reference to these, if you haven't ever taken the time to do core values, especially as a family, like, definitely recommend it. But third one, lead courageously, always stand for the truth. Fourth one is impact the culture, leave your own legacy. And then fifth one is determined to be different and don't settle for average. And I think specifically in context of this book, average people will be completely, I won't say happy, but they'll be content. There won't be enough pain for there to actually be a change. I think it was my dad who told me that when pain is sufficient, change will come. There will be a lot of people who will read this type of material, maybe listen to this podcast, and the pain isn't sufficient enough for them to change. They're going to be content to complain about their job that they hate, and they're not going to do anything about it, which I think is really, really sad. There's going to be a lot of people who are going to be stuck in the level one, you know, trying to manage their time just a little bit better, trying to squeak out a few more minutes of their day. And I guess my whole point going down this rabbit trail is establish those core values and be willing to go deeper, be willing to go beneath the surface, be willing to go to the next level and manage your energy. Because I've seen myself a bunch of positive benefits from this. And even looking back retrospectively at my life and some of the successes that I've had, I realized that this is what I was doing at that particular time. I maybe wasn't aware of it. And because of that, I wasn't able to keep it going. You know, I was bouncing back, like I said, between the positive and the negative, instead of just bouncing back and forth between the high and low intensity. But I really do think that this is really, really critical, and people really need to understand this.
It's fun to me that you have your family mission printed and put on. You put it on the put it up on the wall. Is that right?
Yep.
Yeah, we did the same thing, which is funny to me because I've never seen anyone else do it. It's interesting, but yeah, we have one too. I'll grab a picture of that and we can put both of them in the show notes, and that way people can see them. But I do think, because we need to start wrapping some things up here, but it's interesting to me whenever you read a lot of books in a similar realm that you run across some names, and they're like researchers or doctors in some form, and you run across them in multiple books, and it's sometimes the same study, but coming from a different light, and they look at it a little bit differently. Okay, I need you to say this name.
Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi.
Yeah, okay, you looked it up. Good, thank you. But Mihaly was brought up in this book as well, and was also in, what was it, in Deep Work? What was the other one
in? It's Deep Work. Mihaly's my boy.
Okay, so Mihaly, I just thought it was fun that came up again. But anyway, for what it's
worth. Yeah, he talks about flow, and I mean, it absolutely lines up with what they're talking about here within the power of full engagement. I actually wrote down a quote by Mihaly in which I'll share real quickly. It says, "The best moments usually occur when a person's body or mind is stretched to its limit in a voluntary effort to accomplish something difficult and worthwhile." And that ties back to the four principles. That's going to be the third one, where in order to build capacity, we have to push beyond our normal limits, which is really interesting because most people will try to avoid stress, but stress isn't actually bad. There can be bad stress. There can be stress that you're under because of a situation that is totally avoidable and you just drop the ball and you're living out of emergency scan modality like David Allen would say. But the fact that there is stress is not enough to say that this is a negative situation. Although I guess, you know, Ryan Holiday wouldn't even call it a negative situation. But there's a quote in here. It says, "Well, stress is not the enemy in our lives. Paradoxically, it is the key to growth." So again, managing your energy. You want to go high intensity. You want to push the limits of what's possible. You want to push your boundaries. And that's what Mihaly's talking about. You know, you want to do that. You want to get into that state of flow. You want to enlarge your capacity, so to speak. And then you want to dial back and you want to recover.
So I want to move on to action items, and I only have one down this time, and it's, I don't want to say it's a cop out, but it might be a cop out. You can call me, you can call me out on this if you want. I simply put down, be intentional about my daily routines or my daily rituals. Just because I do take time, and you know, we were talking about this whole cycle of my day thing a couple times here. I do take that time, but I don't always do a good job of making that a renewal time, I guess. I'm pretty good about taking the time off, but it's sometimes hard for me to make sure that my mind is shut off from work so that I'm not focused on, did I get that video edited? Did I get that one recorded? Where am I at in that process? Like, I'm not thinking through that. So I just need to make sure that I'm clearing my mind, and maybe there's a ritual there of something I need to do before I start that. That's probably maybe an action item there. But I just need to be more intentional about those times.
I'll let you get away with that one as long as you give me a definition of done. Like, what does it look like when you successfully do this or unsuccessfully do this?
See, now you got to make it hard.
I got to hold you accountable next time.
It's true. Okay. All right. I'm going to put together a ritual of some sort of a mindset shift whenever I leave the work mode to go to family mode. So I'm going to put together some sort of a ritual in that transition. Does that work for you?
Cool. Yep.
Okay. All right, your turn.
All right, so my turn. The first one I have is to be fully engaged or strategically unengaged. And another way to say this would be to be in control of how I manage my energy. Like I said, there's natural ebbs and flows. You can either go from high to low intensity, or you can go from positive to negative. At least in my experience, it seems to be how it goes. So instead of defaulting to positive, to something then will go wrong, and switching to the negative, being intentional about dialing down and then ramping back up. I believe that if I do that, then the variables in my life, the things that could potentially swing me into the high intensity but negative quadrant, will not be able to do that. And if there is something that maybe is not a ideal or good situation that I will be much be in a much better place to deal with it when I am coming out of monk mode, where I'm laser focused on just doing this thing, cranking out, you know, high intensity, positive energy. And then I'm coming down. Like, if that's the point where I am when my wife says, hey, by the way, Malachi fell off the slide and needs to go to the emergency room to get stitches, which is a true story.
Ugh.
Then I won't fly off the handle.
That does not sound fun.
Yeah, no. So he's good now. So that's my first action point. And then the other one here is they mentioned in the book that they use they talk about tennis a lot, actually. And I used to play tennis, so that kind of resonated with me. But they talk about how the successful tennis players are the ones who implemented that ritual between points. And tennis is interesting because you will play a point, and even if you've got a rally, it's going to last like 30 seconds typically. And then you've got like another minute or so before the next point starts. And the really successful tennis players are the ones that during that minute, they have this ritual where they can kind of calm themselves and refocus. And that helps them execute better. And that is what I am seeing. Reading this book kind of crystallized it for me and showed me that this is what was actually happening when I was managing my calendar the way that I am. I want to not only have the space for those rituals to happen, but I want to figure out what is the best ritual that I can implement, which won't take very long, but I can use whenever I have that little bit of a break within my day to manage my energy, come back down, dial back up before the next point, before the next task, and be more effective that way.
Sounds like a tall task.
It is a tall task, and I probably won't have it completely figured out by next time, but I hope to have something that I can show you is like, this is what I am doing at the moment, and these are the results.
Okay. All right. I'll look for it. author's style. I wrote down repeat, 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 and repeat again. It could have been cut in half. So it just seemed like the two of them, they would put together a point and then they would talk about it and they would put the point together again and talk about it again and again and again and again. It just got to be long, in my opinion. I mean, the content, like what they're talking about is awesome. The concept of oscillations and managing energy, it's awesome, but it just got really long to me.
Yeah, I agree. It was, I think, just under 200 pages if you don't include the appendix with all the resources.
Right.
It probably could have been, if you take out the stories and the repeats, maybe 50 or 60 pages.
Yeah, I could see that pretty easy. So yeah, it's long, in my opinion. I mean, the last couple chapters, well, I think it's the last three chapters, maybe. No, the last four. Oh, wow. The last four, I didn't even underline anything at that point. I didn't take any notes on it. I didn't do anything about it. I just read it. Because nothing new
stuck. I
took
way more notes at the beginning than I did at the end.
Yep.
I'll just reiterate that there were a ton of stories. So if you really like stories, then you'll probably really like this book. They got a little bit old for me. And it seemed... like after a while, it's like, you're just making these people up. But I'm sure they weren't. That's just the impression that I got.
Right.
Was like, okay, you're really trying really, really hard to show me that there are all these people that I personally can't connect with. So it seems like they're made up. And you're just telling me one side of their situation to illustrate your point, and you're doing it over and over and over again. So it just seemed like... I don't know. If there were real names on the people, like really factual people, like Ryan Holiday did this where he talked about historical people like Abraham Lincoln,
right,
and Teddy Roosevelt,
right.
That would have been a little bit different for me because I have a little bit more of a frame of reference. But these people, like you said, it's first name, last initial. It's like, okay, Roger B. Well, hope your life turns out well if you're real.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes them feel fake. And if all of them feel fake, they tend to feel like it's the same person. Like it feels like it's the same story just going on and on and on and on and on. That's what it feels like.
Exactly. That's a great way to describe it. Like if you change the person's name and it took the person's name out and just lined up all these stories, you've got the same story told different ways over and over and over again. It's kind of the way it seems.
Yeah. And since, what did we figure out, like 30 to 40, since there's 30 to 40 of them, it feels like the same story is being brought up 30 to 40 times. That's what it feels like.
Right.
So that by itself, you know, that as compared to the content of it, I'm trying to figure out what I want to rate this, because the actual subject, the content of the process of building rituals and understanding cycles, like that, I want to give a 5. But the style of writing, I want to give a 3. Like, it's just hard. or I don't know if it would go lower than that. But so part of me wants to average that and say a 4, but I feel like it's a book. The writing style and how you come about sharing the information is really important. That's the whole point behind it. So I think in this case, Mike, I'm going to have to dip into the 3.5 range.
That's fair. I am going to say, well, let me just say this, that the reason that we are doing this podcast and the reason that we are reading a lot of books is because we want to improve ourselves. And from that perspective, I feel like the information that he did share, even though it took a lot more words than it probably needed to, I believe that this book is very transformational, especially if you've not read it before like I have. If you've read it before, maybe you have a little bit different perspective on it. But for me, this gave me a lot of revelation and insight. So even though I've got a few issues with the number of stories and maybe how it was written, based on the content alone, I feel like I've got to give it at least 4. I'm going to go 4.5.
That's fair. And like you're saying, I may be colored by the fact that I've read this one other time before. So if that's, you know, if that's probably getting in my way here, that might be part of it. I just know that I have, one, naturally built in a lot of this, and it just seems natural to me. It's just second nature. And I don't know if that's because I read this or if that's just me. So I don't think it had anywhere near the impact on me as what it did on you, which is fine. It's just a difference.
Yeah, that's completely fair. But yeah, I really enjoyed the application of the principles in this book, not necessarily so much reading the book.
Right.
But I can see the results, which is ultimately, you know, why we read the books in the first place. So.
Yep. And speaking of reading books, the ones that we have coming up next. So the next one up on the list is Daring Greatly by Brené Brown. That one is my choice, and I've got it here so I can read the tagline. So the tagline on that one, how the courage to be vulnerable transforms the way we live, love, parent, and lead. So this one's going to step us out of some of the how do you get work done and step us into relationships, Mike. We're going to step on dangerous territory here. Anyway, that's my choice. What did you pick for following that?
I picked Start With Why by Simon Sinek.
Ooh.
I believe that's how you say his name. I've read Leaders Eat Last, which is a phenomenal book. And I've been told by several people that Start With Why is even better. So I am really excited about this one.
Yeah. Now, this is interesting because both Brené Brown of Daring Greatly and Simon Sinek of Start With Why, they've both done some of the most popular TED Talks out there. I know Brené's, I think, is within the top 5. Simon's might be top 5 as well. He's got a TED Talk by the same title. Yeah. I went on a binge of TED Talks for a long time. So every once in a while, I'll say something about a TED Talk that I watched and how this author was that. It's because I binged watched like 100 of them across the period of a few months at one point. So yeah, I got into a big TED binge there for a while. Anyway, getting off of that. So that's the books coming up. I do want to point out, if you go over to bookworm.fm, there is a link at the top right of that page in the sidebar, so you can recommend a book. So if you have an idea of a book that you want to hear us read and talk about, you can go over there and you can recommend that book there. There's also, same place, just scroll down a little bit, there's a book list that has a list of all of the books that we've read are planning to read and that we've had recommended. So you can see that full list over there on the website at bookworm.fm.
Nice. Yeah. And if you want to engage with us in our podcast book club experiment, you can go over to remarks.fm. This is something where you can not only listen to the episode, but you can also leave comments at specific time codes. And we do check that, get notified of any comments that people leave there. We would also love it if you would go on iTunes and leave us a review. iTunes has kind of a funky algorithm for how they rank podcasts, but reviews is one of the things that they rate highly. So if you are enjoying the podcast and you don't mind leaving us a review, that will help other people find the podcast as well.
Good work, sir. And we will get to work reading Daring Greatly. If you want to join us, pick up the book and we will go through that one in a couple weeks.